Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk with Congressman Bob Filner, who is a six-term congressman who represents the border district along the California border. He's also a minority head of the Veterans Committee, and we'll be talking to him about the chances in terms of regime change in the Congress in the upcoming elections, and also how the Democratic Party can counter these sort of scorched earth policies of Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who many accuse of essentially wanting a one-party state. And we'll be talking about that. And we'll also talk with Bill Fletcher, who's the president of the Trans-Africa Forum, and get a preview of President Bush's trip to Africa that begins on Monday. And we'll also speak with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, as the author of a number of biographies on President Nixon and on President Clinton. And we'll be talking to him about U.S. foreign policy and the extraordinary remarks that President Bush made recently, where he effectively goaded America's enemies to kill Americans by saying, "Bring it on." And we'll get a sense of presidential rhetoric and how much this president is out of step with his predecessors. And we'll also speak with, towards the end of the program, with Tim Jamal, who's a public campaign director for California United for Nursing Home Care. We'll be talking about budget cuts that the budget crisis will force on nursing home care as a way into a broader subject, which is about essentially the tyranny of the minority here in California, where the minority can, Republicans can hold up any budget. And indeed, there is clearly a link between the budget impasse and the recall effort on the part of the Republicans. Beginning with you, Congressman Bob Filner, it's hard not to talk about domestic Californian issues. I mean, I'm talking about here the tyranny of the minority in Sacramento, where a handful of people can basically frustrate any legislation. In terms of the way it's working in the House, it seems that Tom DeLay feels that he can get by without you.
Well, that's exactly right. The rules of the House of Representatives, unlike the rules of the Senate, or even the two-thirds requirement in the California legislature for the budget passage, makes it very difficult for a minority to do much in the House of Representatives. However, Newt Gingrich figured out how to do it, and when he was in the minority, and he turned a minority status into a incredible political party that has become, you know, a radical, just radicalizing America life from their perch in the House of Representatives, now and of course in the presidency. And the Democrats have not figured out how to fight back. That is, we are not condemned to just watching all this, but that's how it seems, at least it seems to many of us in the Congress, that's what we're doing. And everywhere I go, people say, "Well, what are the Democrats doing?" And so I sense that we are not handling this our minority status in a way that actually says something about our program.
But the majority leader, Tom DeLay, represents a minority, because in his last election, where he essentially ran uncontested, his major campaign theme was to turn America into a theocracy. And his campaign speech was basically, Jesus should be running America.
Tom DeLay runs the party that he's the majority leader of in a very, very domineering fashion. His own party members are scared to cross him. I have watched him up close and personal choreograph votes where, people who see some of this ridiculous and a real radical nature of his program, and yet will not cross him. And the Democratic Party is not presenting a clear alternative to enlarge the spectrum of American political life. So we can see Tom DeLay as this right-wing extremist. Right now, with the spectrum so sort of moved so far to the right, he looks okay, you know, he looks respectable in Washington. And we have not enlarged that spectrum enough to make him look so extreme that Americans would reject him.
Well, in terms of Congressman Bob Filner, in terms of your referring to the insurrection that Newt Gingrich led, where's the insurrection, or do you have a leader? I mean, he was considered a kind of bomb thrower from the back benches, but he turned that party around in a short period of time, and obviously he went overboard and finally was purged himself.
Well, you know, he went too far. It took him longer. It took him more than a decade to do it. The Democrats, I don't know. Democrats that were a nicer group in general.
Nice guys finish last.
Right. But in what is going on in the Congress, what Newt Gingrich realized, that in a minority in the Congress, if you play by the rules by which the House is run, you lose. That's what Bob Michael, the minority leader for so long, was doing. He just played by the rules. He got stuff for his own little district, but he debated in a very gentlemanly fashion bills that the Democrats would put up, and there would be no real opposition. And Newt realized, hey, if I come to the Monopoly Board and they keep changing the rules so that they always win, I better turn over the Monopoly Board, otherwise I can't, you know, playing is ridiculous. And the Democrats have not come to that conclusion. Most of the leading Democrats feel they can legislate within this context, which is ridiculous. They cannot. They feel that rational debate on the floor of the House will turn somehow the American opinion, and it will not. That's not this. So we need to have at least a group of us, and we're trying to create that, who will overturn the Monopoly Board and say, or the chess board, and say the rules are. You cannot play by their rules, because there's no way that American people will figure out what you're doing if you stay within the rules on Capitol Hill.
Well, how about the notion that we have a contradiction here, at least in terms of foreign policy? You can't fight a global war against religious theocrats abroad if you're in bed with them at home. And their delay leads this core group of 80 or so hardline Christian coalition types who, without sounding partisan here, they clearly do not believe in the two-party system. Their rhetoric indicates that they don't believe the Democrats are legitimate, that they... I mean, it's the same mentality that Richard Mellon Scaife had when he put up $200 million to make life miserable for Bill Clinton. Clinton got elected, but their job was to make him absolutely ineffective by the slings and arrows of a million cuts.
Which they were able to do.
And the same thing that they're doing now in California is to get rid of Davis. Even though he was elected, they didn't like the results of the election, so they come up with an extra democratic way to get rid of him, even though it's in the Constitution. It's
well, part of it, of course, is money. The Republican and those causes have the money behind them that the Democrats don't. Part of it is the increasing control of the media by the one party system. So those are structural constraints for the Democrats to face. But once again, it takes a change in the attitude of my fellow Democrats to understand we're in a war. And to begin to fight it in a way which, Newt and Scaife and the others have fought it. And because if you stick to the what I call the parliamentary game, that is, work within the constructs of a Capitol Hill legislative rules, the American people will never figure out what you stand for. And I used one example, which you're familiar with. I'll just use it briefly again, if I might. We passed the whole budget of the United States of America, $1.5 trillion, in one motion last May, half-hour debate. No way to amend this giant document. It was 1,300 pages, which they gave us a half hour in advance. Now, that's a prostitution of the whole legislative process. But we participated. We took our half-hour debate and said they were wrong, and then we had a vote, and they won. And nobody in America understood really what occurred. I suggested, and I couldn't get enough people to do it, that if 206 Democrats walked out to the Capitol steps and read the budget, Not only would that be a great visual for the press, we could explain what was going on and show the complete, as I said, the prostitution of the process. This was not. This is not a constitutional way of getting things done, and yet they pulled it off because we participated in that process rather than what Newt would have done is change the whole rules of the game.
Well, indeed, theater is very, I know that a lot of people criticize the Texas Democrats for going...
No, that was inspirational to the whole country.
Yeah. You mentioned being outspent. I mean, obviously, the Democrats voted on principle in terms of McCain-Feingold, and I'm sure a number of Democrats are ruining that because clearly the Democrats had some kind of parity in terms of soft money, but they don't have any parity in terms of hard money. And the Republicans are raising money. President Bush has raised more money in the last few weeks than the entire Democrats have raised in the last few months in terms of the presidential campaign.
The Democrats should have a bold statement that the private money that is corrupting this system, we should get rid of. I'm willing to face any Republican on ideas and people. And the money is corrupting it, and yet the campaign finance laws allow that to occur. In fact, many of the Democrats are caught up with it. They're getting paid off by the same special interests that the Republicans are, so that they don't challenge it. But we should have. I think we would become the majority party in America by campaigning against the use of private money in the system. It is corrupting. Nobody who is in the system is unmuddied by it, and the American people know it. That's why they don't vote. They don't see any reason to. They don't see much difference in the parties, and the special interests have bought everybody off.
Well, John McCain certainly got a lot of mileage running on that platform.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It shows how powerful it was, and he only had a little bit of playing around the edges. He didn't even come to a real reform of the finance system. So you're absolutely right. I mean, it shows the power of what I'm talking about when someone seemingly talks straightforward to the American people, like McCain seemingly did. But he was just talking about some little reform around the edges, and as you said, he got a credible response for that.
Well, just in closing then, Congressman von Feldner, I'm not wishing to contradict you, but it seems to me, though, that Tom DeLay's effort, the so-called K Street Project, which is to pass bills where the Democrats are not even relevant, to tell the lobbyists on K Street, give the money to us, don't give it to the Democrats, and in fact to threaten and to punish those who do. The idea is to defund the Democratic Party from any kind of corporate money. Now, you're saying that we should go out and campaign on the purity of not being corrupted by money. But on the other hand, if the Democratic Party loses any kind of parity, any hope of parity, they're just going to be outspent into oblivion, aren't they?
Well, that's what's occurring right now. I mean, that is the fact. Bush will have over $200 million at a time when the Democrats will have been fighting each other in the primaries and will have virtually zero money near the conventions next year. The congressional candidates have two or three or four, sometimes 10 times as much as any Democratic candidate. So that's the fact now. And what we should do is just turn it on them in Newt style and in Judo style and say, that is the problem, that they have 10 times the amount of money to do this, and where are they getting it from? Why are they getting it? Why don't we have a prescription drug benefit because of the pharmaceutical companies? Why don't we have a reform of the health care system because of the insurance companies? And why don't we have a decent energy policy because of the oil cartel? I mean, these are clear issues in America. People sense them, but nobody is talking about them.
Well, the anti-plutocrat ticket.
Well, it's just...
Back to the Gilded Age. Well, in many ways, we seem to be heading back to the Gilded Age, but I thank you very much for joining us, Congressman, and I'd like to stay in touch
Well, we're trying to start a little guerrilla movement. Right now, we're sort of calling ourselves the Mad Dogs. Moving All Democrats is the MAD, but to play on the Blue Dogs.
I thank you for joining us, Congressman von Feldner. Filner.
All right.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Congressman Bob Filner, who is a six-term congressman who represents the border district along the California-Mexico border, and he's a minority head of the Veterans Committee. I'm now speaking with Bill Fletcher, who's the president of the Trans-Africa Forum, and Trans-Africa Forum really were the leading group that brought about America's involvement in the anti-apartheid movement and helped bring an end to apartheid in South Africa. And President Bush is heading there on Monday. Bill, what do you think the president can bring to this troubled continent, two regions bleeding very badly, right next door to Zimbabwe and Liberia, where there's some possibility of the United States intervening? Of course, there's a lot of hope on the part of the Liberians that the U.S. will do so. What do you expect to happen? Let's begin with the possibility of the deployment in Liberia.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on the program. Yeah, I'm sure that there's going to be some sort of deployment. I would not expect a substantial number of troops. I happen to be one, though, that is against the notion that U.S. troops should go to Liberia. I think that the United States should provide financial support and logistical support, but that this really needs to be an African operation, and particularly a West African operation. And the United States has no coherent Africa policy outside of the search for oil. There is no sense that you get from this administration that they have a clue how to approach the situation in West Africa. And I would just, I would tremble at the thought of U.S. troops going in there not knowing what they're doing.
But this has been, the disintegration of this country began, what, over two decades ago with the assassination of the old guard,
right,
who were descendants from American slaves,
mm-hmm,
and they were replaced by Sergeant John Doe, who from all accounts was just a complete imbecile,
mm-hmm,
and a psychotic, and then they've been followed by this clever psychotic
mm-hmm,
Taylor. At some point or other, those that can't help themselves have to be helped, don't they?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Liberia, as you said, is the creation of the United States, and it's a very strange creation. The story is not very well explained here. I mean, part of it is exactly what you said, it was former slaves. But the entire country is not former slaves. In fact, what happened is the former slaves resettled or settled in Liberia, and they settled essentially on top of the people that were living there, and then established essentially what I would describe as a vassal state to the United States, a government and a country that was beholden to the United States. And you're right, there was an uprising in the early 80s, and the country's been in complete turmoil. I guess what I'm saying is that it ultimately has to be up to the Liberians, specifically West Africans generally, to approach the resolution of the situation there. Because Liberia, the Liberian crisis is not disconnected from the crisis in Sierra Leone or the problems in Guinea. And the United States has not a clue as to how to resolve that situation. It needs to be the Africans that are addressing it, and they can utilize, certainly, outside assistance, whether a UN peacekeeping force, a West African peacekeeping force, but fundamentally, African troops need to be deployed there, and who are going to have more of a sensitivity to the actual situation. And I just don't see that happening with the United States.
Well, the British have already gone into Sierra Leone, and the French have gone into Cote d'Ivoire, and they've also gone into the Congo. And Charles Taylor, who's been meddling in both those countries, he lured the rebel groups and Model, the other rebel group opposing him, sponsored by Guinea and, I think, Cote d'Ivoire.
That's right.
And the UN has indicted him as a war criminal. So,
right.
So something has to be done here. I mean, I you know.
But something has to be done, you're right. But the problem is who does it? You know, I mean, the fact that I talked to someone from the Democratic Republic of the Congo who was describing the desperate situation and that they did not particularly want the French to come in, but they were it was simply put, it was desperate. I guess the what I'm suggesting is that in the last year, there's been the formation of the African Union as a way of trying to tie together African states and move towards some level of continental unity. It has to be the African Union or some portion of it that begins to take responsibility for these particular crises. Going back to the colonial or neo-colonial powers to resolve it, in fact, will not resolve it, because one of the things that you see time and again, and it certainly is represented by the Bush administration, is that their notion of peacekeeping is at best the cessation of hostilities. But that's not enough. If you look at the situation, let's say in Angola, where there's been a cessation of the hostilities over the last year, a civil war that had started in 1975, it's not enough to say decommission the troops. If there is not a solution found to economic development, rebuilding the infrastructure, building some level of hope, then what will in fact happen is what we're seeing playing out in Central America now at the end of the civil wars that were going on there. The decommissioned soldiers on both sides end up evolving into criminal elements out of desperation, out of lack of jobs.
And they're all trained killers, too, by the way.
I'm sorry?
I said they're trained killers, too.
Exactly. Precisely. That's what they know how to do. And in Liberia, Sierra Leone, you have soldiers that started as children. That's the only life that they know. And if there's not a total peace process that really involves rebuilding, then it's not a resolution. It's just a respite.
Bill Fletcher, what about Zimbabwe then, the neighboring country to South Africa? There's been pressure put on South Africa, on Thabo Mbeki, to do something about the continual disintegration of this country, once a food exporter, now facing starvation, right, ravaged by AIDS, and with a kleptocratic government that has gotten involved in the civil war in Congo purely to get into the booty business.
Right. The Zimbabwe situation is absolutely tragic. You know, many of us were involved in supporting the Zimbabwe liberation struggle. Many of us viewed President Mugabe as a great hero. And it's been very disheartening over the last 20 years or so to watch the evolution of the country, both in terms of its capitulation to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, but then followed by the desperate manner in which President Mugabe has sought to hold on to power. Now, the part of the difficulty is that the United States and Britain both reneged on promises that they had made to provide financial assistance to move the land redistribution, but they also have begun interfering in the Zimbabwean internal affairs in a way that has polarized or further polarized the situation, so that President Mugabe opportunistically points to the opposition and says that they are agents of U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, when the situation is far more complicated. In fact, the opposition emerged out of the trade union movement and in many cases was led by former allies and soldiers from the ZANU-PF. So the pressure on President Mbeki of South Africa is important, but not pressure from the United States. The United States needs to do far more behind-the-scenes work. What they've been doing is stumbling into the situation, making matters far worse than it could ever be, threatening sanctions, selective sanctions, throwing around the notion of regime change, which makes it more difficult for a meeting of the minds and for a peaceful resolution. My hope is certainly that President Mbeki and other members of the African Union are able to construct a national reconciliation process in Zimbabwe, because if it unravels further, it could move towards a civil war, and that will spread.
Well, the South Africans, for example, have one of the world's great statesmen, Nelson Mandela, And of course, there's some doubt as to whether Nelson Mandela is going to be meeting with President Bush, given that he, Nelson Mandela, recently said, "I don't think I'm going to meet with him. I don't think he wants to meet me."
Right.
So that sort of puts President Bush in something of a difficult position. But President Mandela, former President Mandela's wife, is the wife of the former head of Mozambique. So that's a pretty powerful couple there. Couldn't somebody like that be brought in if Mbeki feels that he can't take it on personally?
You would think so. Let me just say one thing about the Mandela-Bush matter. From every report that I've seen, President Bush made no overture to former President Mandela in terms of having a meeting. And therefore, President Mandela is handling it in a much more graceful way than the Lilliputians that are in the administration here, where he basically is going to be absent at the point that that President Bush arrives in South Africa. In terms of your specific proposal, I think that you're right. It would seem that Mandela and Mrs. Mitchell would be able to serve in some capacity. Now, up until this moment, President Mbeki has directly been involved, as have the leaders of Botswana and Mozambique. It perhaps would be good to have a non-leader, but a great statesman like President Mandela and Ms. Mitchell to be involved. But again, when one looks at the outlines of what the African Union is supposed to be doing, this is precisely the kind of crisis that the African Union should be involved in. And there should be some sort of mediation team that is available. My hope is that the African Union rises to the occasion and is helpful in bringing about national reconciliation.
So in closing, Bill Fletcher, what do you think the president is going to bring to the continent? I know that he's made a proposal on AIDS funding,
right.
And that has met with universal praise. But in terms of the structural problems in the continent with kleptocratic, predatory governments, debt burdens, etc. Where do you think is he going to come through or something?
No, I mean, I think we need to be clear on the nature of this trip. This trip is a photo op. This trip, in the way that it was designed, does not lend itself to a substantive exchange and dialogue with African leaders, heads of state, as well as leaders of civil society. I believe that this trip has more to do with the November 2004 elections and trying to convince a segment of Black America that November 2000 in Florida was really not all that bad. I mean, when we look at it, there is very little that President Bush is proposing that's new. And even when you mention the issue of AIDS assistance, the $15 billion of promised aid was originally implied to be for Africa alone. Now it doesn't appear that that's the case. No money has been allocated for 2003, and under $500 million has been allocated for 2004. Additionally, most of the money that's being proposed is not going to the Global AIDS Fund. And therefore, the question is, where is this money going, and what's the plan? The U.S. continues to provide agricultural subsidies to U.S. mega firms, thereby undercutting agriculture in the Caribbean and Africa. And this is coming from an administration that runs the world yelling about free trade. So I'm saying, what's up?
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles. And I will hopefully we'll stay in touch and we'll see what the president brings to the continent in his trip. And that hopefully it's more than a photo opportunity.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. One good thing about it is that it's provided time for discussions about Africa that normally don't happen in the U.S. media.
And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking there with Bill Fletcher, who's the president of the Trans-Africa Forum. I'm now speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, as the author of a number of biographies on President Nixon and on President Clinton, the Clintons and their America. And Roger, I must say that I've never, in trying to be a student of U.S. foreign policy and of the American presidents, and you've done biographies on two American presidents, and served under two others on the National Security Council. I've never seen an American president literally goading the enemy of America to kill Americans. The other day, President Bush said, bring it on, to the people that are killing the U.S. troops in Iraq. I mean, it's just struck me the worst kind of punkish, you know, schoolboy kind of idiocy. It's just shocking, and it hasn't really resonated with anybody, but it seems to me that this really exposes the absolutely reckless ignorance of our president.
Well, I have to say, as a presidential historian, Ian, I think it's the single most irresponsible remark ever uttered by an American president. I think you search in vain, even in the outspoken and all too vociferous Teddy Roosevelt, who was known for his indiscretions and his flexing of his muscles in the world. I've never heard anything like this. I think it's an absolutely outrageous remark. You know, it's not even contemporary American schoolboy, because we have schools all over America that are trying to model something other than bully behavior. Schools that are trying to mediate violence and trying to show kids an alternative way. We're modeling and instructing one thing in our schools, and we've got a president who is behaving like some street thug in the 1930s. And I just think it's shocking, and even more shocking, as you point out, that there was not an immediate outcry in the Congress and in the public in general. It's almost as if we've come to expect this from this unbelievable administration.
Well, like FDR before D-Day, goading Hitler to bring it on. I mean,
well, I thought instantly of all of the families of service men and women who are serving in the Middle East and in Iraq and elsewhere. It's painting a target on their backs. It's inviting the kind of violence that America has always at least pretended to want to control and to discourage. It's just an incredibly destructive kind of behavior for an American leader. And, you know, George W. Bush doesn't just speak for George W., whatever his own personal pathology may be or his personal problems. He speaks as president, of course, for all of us. And that symbolic role he does not seem to appreciate.
And do you think that he has a handle on what he's gotten himself into in Iraq? I mean, the one thing you can say about this Iraq misadventure is that this is President George W. Bush's war, because he wanted this war. He manipulated intelligence to get this war. He conned and lied to the Democratic leaders in the Senate and in the House to support him, gave them phony intelligence. He overrode General Shinseki, the head of the army. They fired him, or he's, you know, for telling the truth, and he got his war. But clearly, he only had a war plan. He didn't have a peace plan.
Well, he didn't really even have a war plan. I mean, it was improvisational, and as we now know, there was almost no opposition. I mean, I'm not even sure this qualifies to be called a war. It's almost more like an industrial accident, what happened in Iraq. But it's just part, again, of this unbelievable incompetence and folly that they had no idea, apparently, what Iraqi politics were all about, what they were going to be unleashing there. American intelligence had been so intent on overthrowing Saddam Hussein and on establishing something that he didn't really have, which was a sophisticated program of weapons of mass destruction. The politics had so distorted intelligence. The good intelligence, as you say, was crowded out, was simply ignored and shunted aside, and now we have a situation which is arguably even worse than Vietnam in moral terms, because we're not facing an invading army from across some international boundary, however tenuous. We're facing a people who really don't want us there, and for whom we have already become in just a few weeks the oppressor.
Well, clearly the U.S. military are amazingly powerful, and anybody who thought that they wouldn't win this war was obviously deluding themselves. And it you know, the television people obviously packaged it as almost like a ratings game, and everybody seemed to enjoy it immensely. But you were saying it's almost like, on the scale, relatively scale, particularly to real wars, it was like an industrial action or an industrial accident. However, it has, you know, he's broken the China in that part of the world. And it seems to me that what's happening now is that every radical in that neighborhood, from Chechnya to Yemen to Syria, is just rushing into Iraq to kill Americans. It's like they've just brought a whole bunch of Americans in to a part of the world where people want to kill them.
Well, of course, it's not only his remark, bring them on, that paints a target on American troops. It's placing them there in as an army occupying force in a country where they don't belong, with no understanding of the politics there. But, you know, I think this is, again, proof of the old adage that foreign policy is much too serious to leave to the kind of uninformed politicians that we are given to electing in America these days, or given to not electing, as the case in Florida may be. I what depresses me, Ian, is that this is the Vietnam lesson really all over again, never learned. An army and its firepower, its technology, its scientific and financial superiority, which is all it is really, is never a substitute for politics. It's not a force for pacification. They could take Baghdad, but they can't get the lights on. They can defeat the Republican Guard, but they can't build a republic in this new Iraq, whatever it is. And we knew all of that, my God, 30 years ago in Saigon.
Let me just bring on, for a moment, Roger Morris, Wayne Madsen, who's a former, served in the U.S. Navy. He was also served in the National Security Agency, and he writes for Intelligence Online. And you had an article that's now on Counterpunch and on BuzzFlash, Sad Independence Day, Little to Celebrate in a Country Gone Mad. As a former military person, what would you say to our boys and girls in Iraq who are being shot in the back?
Well, I'm, you know, as a former military person, I can understand what they're going through, and I also know from their own generals and admirals and colonels and senior military officers that this is not a popular war amongst the uniform ranks, especially the people who are the military commanders, the 3- and 4-star generals.
Look at General Shinseki. I mean,
Shinseki, awful the way he was treated. Here he was, a 37-year career Army officer. Rumsfeld doesn't even attend his retirement ceremony. Rumsfeld's off in Albania thanking a group of kleptomaniacs.
Right, and all he did was tell the truth to the Congress and say we'd needed several hundred thousand people to pacify Iraq.
Right, and then it's so bad Rumsfeld can't even find a replacement for what is the crowning gem of any career Army officer, to be Army Chief of Staff. He has to dip into the retired ranks and get somebody who's been retired for a couple of years to take the job, because all the active duty generals just despise the group around Rumsfeld so much they didn't want the job.
Well, how come the American people don't know that the neoconservatives are the wrecking crew of American foreign policy? They are neither neo-new, nor are they true conservatives. I mean, they're just... I don't know how to describe them.
Well, that's right. I mean, they're really not neoconservatives. The paleo conservatives, the old line Pat Buchanan types, and Robert Novak were opposed. These people were opposed to this adventure. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things is that the so-called neocons control so much of the media. Look, I mean, you look at Fox News. They have people like Newt Gingrich on, the disgraced former Speaker of the House. And he's just using that as a platform to go after the State Department, where, again, we have another group of diplomats. It was just in the New York Times today that the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq and also to Gabon in West Africa, Joe Wilson, he said, hey, look, I'm the guy that went over to Niger and found out that there was no uranium sales from the country to Iraq, and quotes the then U.S. ambassador to that country as saying, absolutely not. She said, I made that quite known in a report to the administration. And obviously here you have two more diplomats coming out and basically saying we were ignored. You've got people in the CIA who are similarly upset. I just don't know how long this can go on with It's unprecedented to see so many people in the military, the intelligence community, and the foreign service. These are three groups that have never gotten along on policy issues in the past. They're all singing from the same song sheet right now. And
if I were the administration,
I'd be quite worried about it.
Wayne Madsen, that the neoconservatives have united these people. Let me ask Roger Morris. What do you make of these neoconservatives, and how would you describe them, Roger? Because I've known about this group of people for the longest time, and they were Reagan sort of let some of them in. They helped Reagan because they were associated with the Committee on the Present Danger, the ones that dumped on Jimmy Carter and said that the Russians had 10-feet tall missiles, and America had these puny little, you know, the penis envy argument about we had little missiles and the Russians had big ones. And they were successful in helping Reagan get elected, so the number of them were put in the Reagan administration. Bush Sr. didn't want to touch them with a barge pole, thought they were all nutcases. Bill Clinton kept them out of government, but George W. has just invited them in at every level. They seem to be running the show.
Well, I agree completely with both of you. I think they're in a class by themselves. And you know, I wouldn't even, as much as I deplore American conservatism, I wouldn't even sully the word by using it on them. I think these are non-ideological men. I think they're so intent on their own personal power and careers. I think there is an Israeli connection in some cases that's inordinate and basically corrupt. But I think that these are, they're really quite apart from any stream, main or otherwise, in American political thinking. And I must say, I think they're the most dangerous group we've had in authority, in power in Washington in a very long time. But again, it just makes the point over and over, Ian, that you emphasize, where in the world here is the opposition, other than a lonely Bob Byrd and an occasional other voice? Where are the people on Capitol Hill who know this, who know how irrational and how irresponsible this government is? Where are they to say something? And I just want to add this point about the Foreign Service and the military. I'm gratified that there are now these voices coming forward and saying, we told them so, we did this, we did that. But my God, another lesson of Vietnam. Where were these people before this disaster really took shape, before it really happened? We knew all of this way back in January, February, March. They let Colin Powell go before the United Nations and make that fraudulent case in the name of the United States. They let these troops be committed without coming forward. I think there should have been substantial resignations in the Department of State and the Pentagon prior to any American attack on Iraq, and I think this is a little too late. I admire their courage, but I think it's a day late and a dollar short.
Let me just have a quick last word then from Wayne Madsen.
Well, I think what I agree with everything Mr. Morris said, I think that we did see some members of the State Department. I know three of them. The second political officer in charge in Greece resigned. I think many others would have resigned also. I think the thing is, it's like many of us here in Washington, as we thought about the 4th of July yesterday, what can we do? We know things are falling off of this wagon. This was probably one of the more sober 4th of July Independence Day celebrations I've seen, with people heading into the city being stopped in roadblocks. So, yes, I mean, on the 4th, you could not even get into the nation's capital without clearing at least six roadblocks, depending on which direction you were heading. And I think all we can look at now is the election next year and just make sure that this group that has seized power here in Washington is resoundingly defeated in the election.
I thank both Roger Morris and Wayne Madsen for joining us here today in Los Angeles. Bye.
Good to be with you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and that music was from a song called War by Jonathan Brooke, who wrote that back in 1992 for the original Gulf War, but it seems to have echoes of the present. I'm now speaking to Tim Jamal, who's the public campaign director for Californians United for Nursing Home Care. And clearly, Tim, the elderly in this state are going to be victims of this budget crisis. But the real crux of this crisis, surely, is the tyranny of the minority, the fact that two or three Republicans, because of the two-thirds, the need for two-thirds votes on fiscal bills, can essentially hold up the assembly, hold up the state, hang the governor out to dry, and guess what? They've come up with an alternative to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's correct, Ian. I mean, what we have right now is really the perfect storm of term limits, poor redistricting, an unpopular governor, an aggressive national strategy to take George Bush's political fights to state legislatures across the country. Grover Norquist said bipartisanship is like date rape. And we have scared Republicans both in the Assembly and the Senate kowtowing to Senator Brulte, who is George Bush's point man here in California, who the Senator Brulte has threatened any Republican who votes for a tax increase in California, irrespective of whether it helps seniors or helps people live their lives in dignity, he will campaign against them and throw all of the resources he has to make sure they don't get reelected.
And Brulte's already shown what happens to Republicans who don't stay in line. I mean, they get punished. Look what happened to Senator Johansson.
They get punished, and you have the problem, because of term limits, you have each member of the Assembly in particular is, the minute they get elected to the Assembly, they're eyeing a Senate seat. And in order to win a Senate seat, they know they have to win the Republican primary, because redistricting has created nearly safe districts in every seat, statewide seat, or every seat in the legislature in California. So in order to win in these Republican primaries where the base votes, it's considered, you know, the holy grail is to stay in line and say no new taxes, read my lips. And that's what all the Republicans are doing right now.
But all they do and all they've done, this Republican minority, is say no. And the amazing part of it is if they can keep saying no, and the victims of this stalemate are the people that you represent, like the elderly who need nursing home care, and the teachers and the kids of this state. And how come, though, this governor can't point out the fact that this is the problem, that we need some kind of constitutional change here, because the Republicans can get a free ride by being obstructionists and blame it all on him, and combine that with the fact that the Texans, George Bush's friends, who stole the Treasury blind by creating a power crisis here back in 2001 at the beginning of the year. So, in other words, the case can be made for who's really behind the problems of this state.
Well, clearly he needs to respond more effectively, and I think you're going to see some of that in the coming weeks. But we're stepping in where the vacuum is. I mean, we have a campaign across the state of California in every single Assembly and Senate district where we're bringing in nursing home residents, family members, workers, people of Hispanic origin, Caucasians, African Americans, Filipinos, who are calling these assembly members and senators on their hypocrisy. Because people like Bonnie Garcia, for instance, in Palm Springs, who won by 1,000 votes, campaigned to seniors of Palm Springs that she was going to protect them. Yet, when we went up to Sacramento 2 weeks ago and brought in a family member of a nursing home resident, she gave him lip service, without specificity. When we asked her, how are you going to protect seniors? And all she said is she's an independent politician. And then when we ask people like Bonnie Garcia, well, if you're an independent politician, why aren't you voting to protect seniors? And she evades the issue. And I think that's why we're taking it to the grassroots. We're doing these in Orange County and Assemblywoman Lynn Doucher's district, Keith Richmond up there in the valley. And in the absence of an effective encroachment by the media to this double standard, we're bringing real live constituents into offices across the country, particularly Republican offices, and challenging them on their double standard.
And of course, when you have to tie this into the recall effort, I mean, it's not a question of whether or not you like Gray Davis. It's a question of whether you believe in democracy, isn't it? Isn't that the way it should be framed?
Well, it's a question of whether they have an obligation, both moral and electoral, to protect residents of this state. And
you don't get a second chance in an election. It doesn't work that way. You have an election. Whoever
right.
wins is supposed to rule.
Are you talking about the recall effort?
Yeah.
Well, the recall effort is a lot of it sour grapes. I liken it in a similar way to the impeachment effort a few years ago of Bill Clinton. And I think that this is an attempt to reinvent the election that had already taken place. But the problem is that they are constitutionally provided to do it, and we have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who are concerned about the residents of this state, unlike the Republican Party, those of us who are concerned about it have to make this case that the recall effort is nothing but a partisan gambit on mainly on the part of Republicans who lost the election and who are driven largely by a national strategy by people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and
Tom DeLay
and Mr. DeLay. And but that's somewhat inside baseball. This is why the only way to counter this, Ian, is to take it to the grassroots. And we need to do, and I mean those of us in this state who are concerned about seniors and disabled, people who need Medi-Cal and other public services to live quality lives, we've got to take this into the districts across the country, and we're doing it. And I'll tell you what, it makes Republicans uncomfortable. They don't want to talk about the issues. They don't want to talk about things.
Well, of course, they're responsible for the deadlock, but they don't, and the gridlock. But they don't want to take responsibility for the actions that follow from their actions. So, how do you articulate the fact? I mean, first of all, why should the governor fall for? I mean, is there anything else you can cut? Why should the governor cut nursing homes and put elderly at risk, because and allow the Republicans not to take responsibility for it?
Well, I can't defend what the governor has done. I think we have agreed as a team, as a coalition, that the cuts were wrong. But on the other hand, we also know that the irresponsibility of the Republicans, for instance, you have a $40 billion deficit. You can't cut your way out of it. I mean, it's impossible to cut your way out of it without decimating programs like public safety and education and nursing home care. And we need to start focusing on that, on those
revenues. Revenue, right?
You have to have revenues, and they also have something called the spending cap, which is they cap spending at current levels, which is already inadequate, which in essence is a de facto cut in these programs. And the fact that we don't have a revenue source to pay back the debt, they want to saddle our children with paying off the debt in future years, and they don't like to talk about those issues.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get out of this budget cycle painting the Democrats as irresponsible, who've wildly taxed and spent and can't balance the budget, and then next year they'll have another short-term political strategy that'll get them into 2004.
So you really need two constitutional changes in the state. One, to get rid of the tyranny of the minority, so you can't pass any budgets, and they can just stonewall and somehow or other blame it on the on the majority, which is the amazing part of it. And two, this recall statute clearly is being abused.
Recall statute is being abused. I mean, you have people like George Will on the right who distance themselves from these statutes, saying this isn't the form of representative democracy that anyone had decided we would have. And then you have to look at the way the budget is passed. California is one of only three states requires a two-thirds majority to pass a budget. That needs to be reviewed and repealed, because that's not a way in which we as a state can govern ourselves. And being one of only three states, it's obviously not working. And then we have to look at the term limits equation. See that, that's another reason why we're in this debacle and morass that we're in right now.
I'm sorry we ran out of time, Jamal, but I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Tim Jamal, who's the Public Campaign Director for California United for Nursing Home Care. This program can be gotten online at ianmasters.org. Thank you. Bye.